Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Hello and welcome to another Word in Your Ear. This time we're going to travel back to the days of the British blues boom. We're going to travel back to the days of musicians wanted ads in the Melody Maker. The days of amusing yourself before gigs by counting the amplifiers. The days of no time wasters. The days when you got changed in the chip shop. To the slightly more luxurious surroundings of playing in the no expense spared circuit of the Enormo Domes of America with Whitesnake. The book is Where's My Guitar?, which has been described by Joe Bonamassa as a fantastic document of a time and place we won't ever get back again.
He's right.
But we can do something about that right now and welcome the author of this book, Bernie Marsden. Bernie, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm very good. We're fine. Where do we find you?
I'm in Buckinghamshire on the Bucks North, Northampton, Oxfordshire border, really. I live near Buckingham.
Which is where you were brought up, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You were brought up a little bit outside Buckingham, and there's lovely bits about, you remember, vegetables and milk being delivered by horse-drawn carts. It's fantastic.
It's true.
Remember, 51. What are your memories of the place?
Just of being in a very small rural town, and thinking it doesn't get any bigger than the town hall once I discovered artistes and stuff, and dreaming of playing there, and then getting a whole tour of the local village halls and stuff like that. But that was going forward a bit. I just grew up as just a normal, junior school, primary school kid in Buckinghamshire, and then along came the Beatles, and I picked up a guitar. So that was the start of it. So that's why I've kind of kept that part of the book so people could relate to being me, maybe in those days as well, in the 50s and 60s, because to be you say to anybody, even much later, well, what are you going to do when you leave school? I say, well, I'm going to play the guitar. And it was a great source of comedy to people, but I had to get away with it.
Who were the first guitar heroes then that you remember seeing?
Without a doubt, Hank Marvin, because he was the man, one of the few people you saw on TV with a guitar. And then once I got into playing it for sure, I suppose, there's only one main influence, and that's Eric Clapton, which is pretty much all of us with that, the Yardbirds into the Blues Breakers thing, and because of him, we all got to discover the other guys. Then along came the Jeff Becks and Jimi Hendrix, and through them, you could discover the blues guys where they got their influences from. And, try finding a Freddie King album in Buckingham when you're 14.
It's possibly difficult. Let's go back. What was the first guitar you got?
My parents, bless them, they managed to. A cousin of mine had a guitar, and I must have made some kind of decent noise on it, because I must have gone on about it for a few weeks or whatever. And they did source me a guitar, and to this day, I never did really ask them where it came from, but the guitar did arrive, and said, "This is for you." And thinking, well, I think it was let him get over it and leave it in the corner, and then we'll never have to put up with this noise again. And then I think I always cut to the chase, really. But I think I played the theme from, I think it was either Coronation Street or Z Cars or something. And I played, I said, I can play this. And when I couldn't, it was pretty cool. But both of them, I can remember their eyes going like, wow. And the moment I saw their eyes widen, I said, can I have an electric guitar, please? And that was the deal with my dad. Then, well, look, you've got some pocket money. You do a paper round and all the usual stories. And we went to the very, I didn't realise at the time, that maybe I did, Selma's in London, because I had a family in London, and I went on the 24 bus. And I saw Selma's shop from the bus side. I got off the bus. I was only about 13.
In the Charing Cross Road?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is where Eric Clapton and everybody bought their equipment, didn't they?
I didn't know that. And I'm in there. Yeah. And there's this 13-year-old squib from Buckingham, you know, looking at 150-pound guitars, saying, I quite like, well, can I test this one, please? But they never threw me out. They were always great. And a few guys, you know, much later on, after I turned pro, were still around. And they sort of said, well, they, you know, do you, you don't remember me. I said, no, but there were a lot of kids like you who are now, you know, doing pretty well. And it was really a sweet, innocent time, really.
So there was something about the kind of the shine on the window of a music store, wasn't there? There was, yeah. It was kind of otherworldly, wasn't it?
I had never seen real American guitars in the flesh until that day on the bus. I'd seen them on TV. I'd seen them in the Melody Maker or in magazine. It probably wasn't even Melody Maker in those days. But you'd seen them on TV. And to think that we used to see a Fender Stratocaster close up and then he'd actually touch it was quite something, you know. And only not that long after, the regional shop started to stop because it wasn't easy even to get stuff in those days because there was a heavy purchase tax on them.
Yeah, there was.
Yeah.
You know, we're really getting back now. I don't think I'm quite that old.
But it did affect
the prices.
Hank Marvin's was the first Stratocaster in this country, wasn't it?
Because I believe
it was ordered mail order because it's the only way you could get them.
The controversial one, because is it Hank's, is it Bruce's, or is it still?
Oh, is C.
Oh, okay.
Oh, do they still?
This is new.
I've talked to them all over the years about it, and every one of them sort of says, yeah, it's definitely Cliff's, but I'm keeping it.
Oh,
I think Bruce has got it, and long may he reign to do so.
Because
I think it was the first one.
Cliff paid for it, didn't he?
Yeah,
that was the deal.
Yeah. Yeah,
Hank had the catalogue, said, get the most expensive thing.
He had a Buddy Holly and the Crickets album, and they said, we want one of those, and there's the strap. But they got the wrong one, the wrong colour came. So that was what happened.
And people used to go to their gigs just to stand there and look at it, didn't they? I mean, it was a major thing.
Oh, I would do that. I can remember doing that, just standing at the front of a, you know, even like a 12-inch stage, and there the guy would have left his guitar. No guitar stands in those days. We propped up against, and I'm just looking at it. And people come and say, come on, come and sit down. I say, no, I'm just looking at this. You know,
tell us about some of the groups that they're lovely. The James Watt Compassion, Clockwork Outstrap. Tell us about
that. What was that all about? That was one.
Well, Clockwork Mousetrap is very of the times.
Clockwork Mousetrap. I had nothing to do with it.
Totally alarm clock.
I was a 15-year-old guitar player. They decided to change their name to the Clockwork Mousetrap and paint the van to suit. And I was even then, I was quite horrified.
Was it Silence is Golden and Bee Gees covers? And then there was some issue where you were instructed to wear a certain stage gear, which was the point where you left the band. What did they want you to play to wear?
But Silence is Golden was a big, big record. I mean, nowadays I realise what a great song it is. Yeah. You know, Four Seasons. Yeah. I wasn't aware of all that. But it was always on the TV with, what were they called? The Tremolos.
The Tremolos, yes.
It seemed to be every band that I was in from 13 to 16 wanted to play it because people wanted it because it was a hit, I suppose. And I just grew to hate it and stuff. And all these other songs that would crop up, then suddenly someone would play to me something like Rave On by Buddy Holly or something. So, well, why can't we? That's a Buddy Holly song. Why can't we do that? And they would say, no, it's not a hit. And that would be the reason why you couldn't. I mean, the other songs, I don't know really. Some of them were, I just learned to play them and insisted on playing them. I mean, even if I had my own spot in the bands I was in when I was 15 or 16, I played them pretty badly, but at least I get a chance to play them. So it was good.
So eventually, I mean, your personal interest was the kind of, I suppose, what became the blues boom, you know, that those of us who remember it was probably didn't last that long, but it was hugely influential at the time. And you were in, tell us about your group Skinny Cat and their experience of the blues boom.
Skinny Cat was at the end of that period, really. And that was the first local band that I had that I more or less became in control of. I was the kind of center point of it. When I joined the band, there was other people who suddenly left and I ended up singing instead of the singer. And the horns went and something else went and they said, well, you can do that. And the rhythm guitarist, he got jettisoned as well. And I thought, well, I can do this probably. And then somebody said, well, can you do it? And I go, yeah. It wasn't a matter of taking over. It was just one of those ordinary things. But it was a time when, you know, this glorious time, wasn't it, when you could look at the Melody Maker and say, well, Friday we'll go and see Hendrix, Saturday the Cream, Fleetwood Mac on, and they say, well, we saw Fleetwood Mac 2 weeks ago. Come and see somebody else, you know. And just work out. And there was a drive for, locally from around here. And the big gig around here for me was the Dunstable California Ballroom.
Oh, yes.
And I saw Fleetwood Mac there. Many of us saw Freddie King there. I just, and it was 40 minutes away, you know, all piling in one of the guys' minis. And I mean, so that was an eye opener. And I think I saw Chicken Shack there one night with the guys. And I'd auditioned for a couple of people at the time and sort of got the gigs. But it was the Melody Maker was great and everything, but it never told you who the band was you're auditioning for. It rarely said, the Straub's Seek lead guitarist. It was like lead guitarist needed for name band with work.
Yeah, there you go.
And you go work. To the audition, and then you think, well, maybe we'd like to offer you the gig. And you say, who's the band? And one of those bands was East of Eden. And I said, oh, I don't really think that's me, really. And Jeff Allen, bless him to this day, has always said to people, hey, with an arrogant little sod he was. He came up for the gig, got the gig, and turned it down.
So you went for it. You actually did an audition with East of Eden. East of Eden, famous for... And Jim Barbus, the violin player, played the violin on The Who, Won't Go Full. I can't remember one Who song.
Yeah.
And they had one hit.
Yeah.
They said, thank you, you can join. You said, no, thank you.
Yeah, it was like,
when you discovered who they were. I love that idea.
I think another one, and they were really great people, was Renaissance.
Oh, yes.
And that was, I mean, but. I was listening to
kind of medieval folk rock band with it.
Yeah, it wasn't exactly my thing. And you'd play with these guys. One of the other guys in the band was a great piano player called John Hawking, who was in the Nashville team.
Yeah.
So we're jamming in the afternoon, and I'm playing, doing my Freddie King impression the best I can and stuff, and playing as bluesy as whatever I can. And then he was into it. Just you play great, mate. Oh, we're gonna have some fun. I said, oh, yeah, what's the band called? He said, oh, it's Renaissance. Oh.
I get my coat.
Yeah. Why didn't you say earlier? That was not a lot of time.
Subsequently, I realised, you know, what a nice, decent prog rock band that they were, but it really wasn't, for me at the time, it was just like a non-starter. So Skinny Cap, we're in on the end of that blues thing, and then we could go and see Fleetwood Mac, and then every time you saw somebody, and you go, well, you know, in your dream of dreams, that was your level, right. And to see Peter in his prime. And I went to see them at Dunstable, and Danny Kirwan, I think it was his second gig or something. And I wanted to hate him so much because he was the same age as me, even a bit younger, I think. And he was in Fleetwood Mac, and I came out of that gig, and he was so good. I just came out thinking, yeah, you better up your game a bit if you want to do this. So Skinny Cap became the springboard to go into being a pro, and I joined UFO.
What levels did you go to imitate those kind of people? Because Eric Clapton, a lot of it was about the clothes he wore. I mean, did you go buy the same stuff?
I bought a pair of Tough Chow shoes after I read that you wore them when I was about 16. You know, tough Chow shoes, I remember that. I think they were just school shoes, really, but I remember somewhere he'd written, so I thought, maybe one of those things, maybe I can play a bit like him, I've got the same shoes. I mean, he did the same thing after he saw Hendrix, didn't he? You know, maybe I could play a bit like if I've got my hair like it.
Well, that was the interesting thing about all those guys, because they all kind of had a gimmick, didn't they?
Yeah.
Well, Stan, Chicken Shack, you'd have the really long...
Oh, yeah, the 30-foot lead went out into the audience to play.
Yeah. The street and play.
Yeah.
Scaring the children. I think it was at Dunstable one night. I think we were watching Chicken Shack, and I think they were maybe even backing Freddie King. And I was... raving on about Stan and I thought what a great guitar player he was. I think it was the bass player or the drummer in my band, Skinny Cat, said, well, you're as good as that. And I'm looking at the pro, you know, from the outside of the stage. And it really hit me afterwards that the guy with me, who was in my band, said, well, you could be doing that for real. And it was quite a profound moment, really, when I look back on it afterwards, because I wanted to do it, was that leaving that band. I mean, Mike Vernon came to see Skinny. And I got a nice letter from it saying that, you know, you're pretty good, kid, but but the band ain't going to make it. And I did want to show them that letter because there was our band, and you know, you try and stay tight to it at the time. So I kind of knew at some point I was going to have to make the jump myself. And UFO came along, and that was where it all began.
But you also went to see Mike Vernon, didn't you, I think, to try and get a publishing deal? Is that right?
That was the same time, really.
He
was one of the few, to credit to this day, who from London, you know, in the real settings of what I was working in, he did actually come up, I think it was to a gig in Northamptonshire, to see the band live. He thought we were good enough to, you know, the tape was good enough to come and see us live. And afterwards he just said, I think, you know, you've got loads of promise and potential, but I think the band are a little bit behind you, kind of thing. So I never got anything. Maybe I should have took that. I might have been Danny Kerwin at the time. I don't know. But it was going into that situation. I went to Apple as well in Savile Row with the same tapes, really. And they were really sweet. They were just, when I look back now, you think about it, it was a fantastic time. And it was crazy in there. It was crazy. And when I look back now, I think just the fact that I went there is.
So you just turned up at Apple with the tape. Did you see anybody you recognised, Derek Taylor or George Harris?
I saw James Taylor because.
Taylor, of course, he was
very hard to miss.
Yeah.
You know, the ball guy, you know. But I knew him from his earlier music only because of his appearance, really. And we had a very, very brief word. And you know, he said, "No, I'm in a band. I've got my quarter inch tape." And he said, "Oh, these guys are really good." You know, because he'd been signed by them, and
he was the only person, wasn't he?
I think so. Yeah, and the guy did take my tape, and one of the very few times it happened, they made a cassette copy or something of my tape, and said, "You'll hear from us," you know, and I don't think I ever did, but I never experienced anybody taking a tape away except for when I went to DJM and. The very person who took my tape away that day was none other than Elton John. And you couldn't make that up, could you?
No. Was there any response from him? Did you ever hear what he thought of it?
No. I mean, but it was a fantastic bloke. And I've never seen him from that day to this. But he took me to he felt sorry for me, I think, because I sat waiting to see. I thought Dick James, but it turned out to be Stephen James.
Oh, right, yeah.
And I think I had an 11 o'clock appointment. You can imagine, I'd gone up from Buckingham in the morning. And all excited, but I knew about Elton John because Lady Samantha was pretty much hot on the radio at the time, and he looked a character at the time. He came in, he had denim stuff, had patches all over him and stuff like that. But he worked, I think, in those offices. Well, I know he did. And he walked by and he said, "You've been here for ages. Who are you?" I said, "I'm here to see Mr. James." And he went, "Mr. James, he's not here." And I said, "Oh," and I must have seen me face go like, "Oh, you know." And he said, "I'm just going off for my coffee break." He said, "Do you want a cup of coffee?" And the first real cup of coffee I think I ever had in my life was with him at the Gioconda in
That's bad. So it was not instant coffee; it was proper coffee.
Was that? Yeah, yeah. And he paid for it as well. And I said, "I've got." No, I said, "We'll put that down to making Stephen James make you wait." And it was great.
Lovely.
It was fantastic. I never had a chance to thank him ever since, except I do in the book. But it was really, you know, but to me, I'd heard Lady Samantha and I thought it was a great song. I thought, this is great. But there he was, right in front of me, you know, saying, "What are you doing? You've been here for an hour." You know, that was it. Strange times, but it was a thing I wouldn't change because Skinny Cat gave me that impetus to go into those places and try one more time to get that deal, which never happened.
Yeah. But then you joined UFO, as you were saying a minute ago, and it fell out. I mean, it fell out really badly with Phil Mogg.
Yeah,
and there's a bit where you actually end up thumping him on stage.
Some days we didn't fight. Yeah.
So, what was it about him that made him so difficult?
Looking back on it, I think I do say at the end of in the book. No matter what, because I have a go all the way moaning and groaning about UFO, but I do say, but without UFO, I wouldn't have had that break and I wouldn't be writing this book, which is very true. And Phil and I was just a balance of minds, really. And I think before me, he had been totally in control and doing exactly what he wanted to do within the setup. I started asking questions, you know. I said, well, hang on, you know, we're working 5 nights a week. And what does the band get the night? 150 quid? And why do I get £15 a week? I don't ask questions like that. You know, I said, well, I am going to ask questions like that. And then we say, well, we'll get more money when we go to Germany. So shut your face. And they would call me country boy because I was from down, you know, from down here. And they were all London. But they weren't even real Londoners either. You know, they were all from like Tottenham and
steady on with Tottenham.
All North Londoners, but you know what I mean. They weren't Cockneys.
No, okay.
But you see, I did it for all the wrong reasons. That they were signed to Chrysalis, they had agency management and a record deal apparently, and they were going to Japan very quickly. And I thought, everything's, you know, and all the guys in Skinny Cow said, you got to do this one, you got to do.
Yeah.
So I did, and I didn't, I knew musically it was a bad move. You know, I thought, and having then turned, already said no to these other bands, I could go into this pre-heavy metal band. And I'm trying to play like cool BB King stuff.
Yeah.
It didn't work, really. I think I say, I went from being quite a big name in North Bucks to being fairly well known in Northern Europe.
Right.
And that did change everything. I mean, then I'd start getting a bit of a following because lead guitarists do. And my name started to say at the second German tour, they started putting UFO featuring me.
Oh, that doesn't go down well.
Oh, man, I had this terrible row going on in the promoter's office thinking, what's going on here? And it was Phil and the promoter. He was moaning at the promoter for putting my name on the poster. And I couldn't understand it because of my naivety of coming from the countryside, because I was very green still to the business.
Yeah.
And so, hang on, we're in the same group here. It was like being in a soccer team. And don't pass him the ball, he might score, kind of thing. And he said, no. He said, we don't have any of that. We're a group. And it went downhill pretty much after that. And now he hit me in the face at the London School of Economics one night. I thought somebody had thrown. I'd broken a string, and we hadn't been getting on that well. And Supertramp, we're on the bill with Supertramp, Roger Hodgson. I mean, you couldn't have more chalk and cheese, honestly. Supertramp in the afternoon, we're apologising to each other if the bass or the guitar was a little bit loud in their monitors.
Yeah.
Whereas if I had said that to Bob, he would have demanded another 1,000 watts.
Yeah.
To be in my monitor of him singing. That was the difference.
Yeah.
So during the gig, the sound was going, I broke a string and I didn't have tech in those days. I changed the guitar within about 20 seconds, you know, unplugged it, put the spare on. And I felt this thing hit me on the side. I thought somebody had thrown something from the stage. And it really hurt a little bit after a while. I started to well up a bit. And I looked across at the late Pete Wablers, we're still playing in the middle of some boogie in G or A or something, just on and on and on. And I'm looking at him mouthing, and he just hit me. And Pete Way is crying with laughter, going, doing this. So I took this little Les Paul Junior, which was a very sturdy little guitar, and while Phil was at the microphone, I slammed it across the shoulders with it like this. Bang. And he went down the microphone, still singing professionally. But we never did have a real bad fallout after that again. But I didn't stay with the band that long after that either. I saw Michael Schenker first time around, and he was amazing. And I was the one who said, this is the guy you should have in the band. And then Phil Mogg said, we don't look at support groups. But we've seen each other many times since, so we're fine.
I think the next band was Wild Turkey, Glenn Tornick's Wild Turkey. A former member of Jethro Tull.
Yeah.
And I was intrigued by your account of touring with Wild Turkey, which you used to get around in a Chevrolet. Is that right?
Indeed, yeah. Three seats in the front, three seats in the back. Plenty of room for illicit bourbon.
But still stayed in the most kind of low-rent kind of bed and breakfast, didn't you? Kind of most knackered.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Smith bed and breakfast and stuff like that. And sometimes we'd pull up outside of our supposed night stop and go and look at each other and go, nah, we just keep going and go straight to Glasgow or something or whatever. We drove to Madrid overnight from London. We just started in London at 3 p.m. and Glenn never stopped. But Glenn is the man who turned me on to Frank Zappa. And that was a turning point in my life as well. You know, Glenn was a lovely guy. He was very great bass player and very knowledgeable. And also was probably responsible for starting me off on the guitar collecting as well. But it was a wild time. But Turkey, we were in Spain when Franco was very much in charge. And of course, you can imagine 1974, hair down. Well, sorry about that. I had my haircut for this. By the way,
we noticed. Touched.
Lockdown. And we were all running around. They had the secret. Well, they weren't very secret police. They had people following us around everywhere
because t-shirts say secret police.
We stopped on the way back from Zaragoza one day. It was about 110 degrees. Stopped for a beer at a hacienda place or whatever, and we took the beer outside, and that gave them a chance to arrest us. Because we took beer onto the street. And the next thing is, one of them was a Jethro Tull fan, and we ended up, instead of being arrested, we ended up with a police escort into the next town. Unbelievable. Unbelievable stuff. The guy was humming Living in the Past and going, Jethro Tull, Jethro Tull.
Moving on, I just want to ask you about somebody you knew and worked with a bit later on, but as a session man, which is Mickey Most.
Yeah.
And you say you kind of learned more from Mickey Most than most people. Is that fair to say?
I think I learned more about making records from Mickey Most than anybody. Because to watch him at work, a guy wasn't very talented musically. He had the instruments and he had the know-how. But in the studio, to make a record that was going to be played on the radio, I've never come across anybody like him since, really. I mean, I wasn't in and out of the studio with all the great producers of our time, but I would say he must have been one of the best.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And he was a guy who either, a bit of a Marmite guy, I think. You know, talk to Jeff Beck about him and you probably get a whole different story, but, you know, he was always very pleasant to me and he hired me for a lot of sessions.
Yeah, you play on You Sexy Thing by Hot Chocolate, didn't you?
I believe so, yeah. Because we did backing tracks. And he would say, Bernard, I'll come and pick you up from your flat in London, in Devonshire Terrace, I used to live. And he had a Rolls Royce. And in those days, he had a phone in his car.
Oh, yes.
I mean, it was so impressive, man. And for him to come and get me, you know, this was just Mickey, you know, I'll come pick you up 4 o'clock, because he had a mobile studio pretty much parked up in the front part of his garden at the house. So that's where I would go with him. But sitting in his car, listening, watching him pick up a phone to talk to his wife about I'm on the way home was amazing, you know.
It was.
And then he would say, well, we'll go in the studio, and there was a load of backing tracks, and I didn't know whether it was, you know, he had so many acts signed to Rack. But I was pretty good with, you know, and I've been listening to a lot of stuff with, you know, Motown stuff. And I liked the rhythm, and I was pretty good with the Wild Wire stuff. And he got me on all that stuff. And then only afterwards, years later, I think it was dear Patrick Olive from Hot Chocolate said to me, you said, well, you played on most of the records. You know?
You didn't really? Know.
I didn't know. No, I think I definitely played on Heavens on the Back Street of a Cadillac or something like that.
Right.
And Emma, I think. I didn't do the famous guitar part of You Sexy Thing. I think I was the rhythm guitar part under it. So I would remember doing that. Right. That was almost certainly, you know, the guy from Hot Chocolate. But I played on other songs that I still don't really know what they were. Probably Racy and did I do some Susie Quattro? I don't know. may have done. I think she had different producers, but you never knew a Mickey because he would just say, I think this one's in A, this one's in G, this one's, you know, whatever. And there were no top lines, very rarely.
Right.
He was a great bloke to be around. He was funny, man, because he'd come from that 50s era as well. And he'd toured with those package tours in the 60s. And I just gravitated towards sitting with him on the bus and stuff, or in his car, and chatting about him. He was, I wish, you know, these days you could put the phone on and record everything, but he was I really, really liked him. And
I like the idea that he had a butler, didn't he?
Oh, that's that was the day we were, one of the days he phoned his wife and he said, I've got Bernie for dinner. And he took me, and it must have, obviously the lines must have been so bad. And the only Bernie she knew wasn't me. But when I got there, a butler opened the door and said, good evening, sir. And Mickey was looking, going, what? And he said, you better go in the studio. So I went into the mobile and then back into the house. And the table was all laid out with lovely candelabra and stuff. And his wife came down, who was a delight, and lovely, lovely, lovely lady. And he said, oh, this is my wife, Mrs. Bernie. And her face went, can I work, Mick?
She's obviously crestfallen, was she?
Well, yeah, I hated to disappoint her, and I love her to this day. But the only Bernie she knew was Sir Bernard Delfont.
So she dressed up and
she dressed up and everything.
Got the tomfoolery on. Yeah.
And the butler was like, good evening, sir. And it got so bad. I was kind of embarrassed. And they were laughing their heads off, to the eternal credit. They were so funny. She never took the tiara off. And it was really, really funny. She said that there was a plate glass door in this dining room. And they told me about 10 times, be careful. But I'd had too much to drink. And I went smack into the player and ended up with a shiner up here. And she said, you know, you have to stay the night because you can't drive home or whatever the hell. And she looked after me like a nurse. And I loved her from that day to this. And it was one of those. And now I was told that he dined out on that store for quite a bit as well.
But yeah. Mickey Mouse is a classic example of you've got it flaunted, wasn't it? It's kind of butler. Yeah. Massive house, yeah. Rolls Royce with a phone in it, you know.
Yeah, amazing. I couldn't, I mean, I've got my Levi's on, Levi J, hair down, whatever. And this is Bernie, and her face was just like, can I have a word? It was like,
that's lovely.
That's a sitcom.
It is.
Yeah. I suppose the transitional moment in your career is when you joined Pace Ashton Lord. Is that fair to say that you kind of move up to the...
The first division really was playing with Cozy Powell after Wild Turkey.
Right.
Cozy was such a great player. You know, as musician-wise, two steps up instead of one or three or whatever. And he was a big influence on me, especially with Mickey's situation, because it was his hit record that introduced me to Mickey. But his attitude to the business also had a lot of effect on me as well. It was like a very much a, come on, let's get on with it. All right, yeah, we're in the studio, so okay, that's Carl Palmer over there. Who cares? You know, he was one of those kind of guys. He liked Carl Palmer, but, you know, everybody was the same to us. And he instilled in me that kind of get-on-with-it business in the studio rather than being too precious about, you know, spending months and months to get the drum track right. He was very much getting there at 12 o'clock and let's be out there by 2.
Right.
And he was a guy who was very influential on calling around and making sure that he did the right job. So he would then say to me, I've got this gig for you. And it was Pace Ashton Lord. And I was more terrified of not getting the gig and having to tell him than not getting the gig. But as it happened, I did get the gig. So that was all right. And that was another step, because working with John and Ian was just another two rungs at a time. Tony was a different thing.
Tell us about Tony. You did a certain amount of driving Tony from the pub to the gig, didn't you?
Only every day, yeah. I was the one tasked with getting him to the rehearsals. And I would go to the Richard Steele's, which I think is still up on Haverstock Hill. And getting him out of there every day was a game, just a game. And all his mates, his drinking partners, and there were writers, TV producers, actors, and everybody was against me. And the names they used to call me when I used to arrive with the car to go in and get him, I mean, you wouldn't believe, they were disgraceful, really. Oh, you really are a really nasty little twit, aren't you? And Ronald Fraser was the word, the actor Ronald Fraser. I mean, I hated that man for no other reason than he was horrible to me. You know? And I'd take him down there and drive down, thinking I'm going to get such a rollicking now from John because we're 2 hours late. And they say, no, he said, that every day, the fact that you get in here is a miracle. Tony was just an absolute mission on his own. It was, and why was In Pace Session Lord was only because he was John's mate, really. You know, I mean, you think about it, you've got John Lord playing keyboard. You don't really need another keyboard player.
No, that's true.
He hates guitarists. I play something, look at me and go, oh, noise, you know. And I said, what am I supposed to do, you know? And you want to say, take no notice of him, dear boy, take no notice of him. You know, Casey just laughed in the corner. So Casey Ashton Law went into, third gear and ended up in fifth gear, totally out of control with nothing to do. And we did five shows in Great Britain, five. And they went back to Munich to do a second album and it was all over. But in that interim period, I'd met David Coverdale.
So
that's the big connection.
So tell us about that. There are bits that are just comic, really, aren't there? There's the Love Hunter, the controversy over the Love Hunter sleeve with the snake and the naked girl. Or and there's a bit where you go to Graceland and things. I started to think, well, when you watch Spinal Tap, how did you feel? Do you think you'd live this movie?
Nobody laughed. I said, well, that's true, isn't it? That's Black Sabbath. Yeah. That actually happened. We did that. No, it was Spinal Tap. To most, I think you'll talk to anybody from my generation of players in rock band, and nobody found that film very funny at all. I mean, it's a great film now. That is, it's hysterical, but you know, they nailed it so well that people did think it was real, and I suppose in a way it was real. You know.
But when you saw the sleeve of Love Hunter, as a naked woman astride the large snake, did you think, oh, that could be a problem?
What's wrong with being sexy?
What year is it? Who am I? Do you know, the honest truth today, and honestly, when they say the first Wednesday, I'll tell you honestly, and that means it's the first lie. But no. Only David Grealish ever saw that scene.
Right.
None of us even saw. I never saw the cover to Trouble, Love Hunter. I never knew that until 2 years afterwards that the picture of me on Ready and Willing is the same as the one of me on Trouble. That's how much interest the rest of us really took in the artwork. It was not David's thing, really. And, you know, he was the one dealing with all the lyrics, and he was the one dealing with journalists, especially female journalists, who took, you know, some offence, well, and in some cases, rightly so. And then say, well, you're the one who recorded Lie Down, I Think I Love You. And I said, well, yeah, but it was very much, you know, with David's stuff, it was all very tongue-in-cheek. And it was done as a bit of fun. It wasn't meant, I think, to... put anybody down or look for a reason to be controversial. We weren't that clever enough, I don't think. It looked like they've done it again, you know, and then we fell into the trap because Come and Get It came out, and then there was a controversy with that, and then the Americans changed the artwork, and they've done it again, you know. It was, again, none of us really, in fact, I've been in touch with somebody only recently who did the artwork for Come and Get It, and that original has gone missing. So, but we never had a great deal to do with the cover. So in answer to your question, really, you know, Love Hunter, I was more interested in what was inside the cover.
You co-wrote one song. Well, you probably co-wrote more than one song, but there's one particular song from that era that has kind of outlasted that era. Tell us about that and how important that's been to you and to your career.
You mean Here I Go Again?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
Here I Go Again, I wrote for the last, what turned out to be my last, Whitesnake album. And ironically, it turned out to be the last track we recorded as well, funnily enough. It was put together at my old house, which isn't 5 minutes from where we're sitting now. But I put a demo together with my old Revox, and I had a cassette of it, and I knew that there was something good about it, and I wanted to play it today. We got to Clerwell Castle, and I sort of kept thinking, well, should we work on this, and I'll get this together a bit better. And so I worked on it a bit more, and only towards the end of the first sessions down there, I took it one Saturday afternoon it was, and I played it to him, and I sang it through the chorus, and I sang through this piece to the part where it goes from a kind of a minor to a major thing, so it goes from into the positive kind of side. And he just really liked it, and he said, "Oh, I'm going to rewrite some of this," and because I had an idea for the chorus, an idea for some one. I think the second verse was the original first part, stuff like that. But you know, that was the deal we had, him and I. You know, if we were in a room together, then we wrote a song together. And he disappeared up into his room at Clearwell Castle, and only I think that was about 5 o'clock. Came back down all motivated and said, "What do you think of this?" And he more or less had it finished. I think we recorded it a couple of days later. But it was only me, John, Ian, and David, and there's only four of us, I think, on the track. And John Lord heard the intro I played on little figure on the guitar, and he looked at me and said, "Play that again." I said, "What, this?" And I played it to him, and he said, "You're a clever little sod, aren't you?" He said, that's a hook. He said, "That's a real hook, and I'm going to play that on the Hammond organ." So I gave in immediately because it was the great John Lord. He didn't argue with John. He never wanted to. He was such a huge mentor to me. And we recorded it, and it was a hit over here, and it did okay. And then the band broke up, and 5 years later or whatever, it's re-recorded with the new All-American Whitesnake, and goes to number one. And the rest is writing books.
It always fascinates me, Bernie, because I've tried this with numerous musicians. You can have long careers, you do loads of things, loads of different things. In the end, it's one song.
Mm.
Is that true in your case?
Yeah. I mean, if you break it down, even monetary wise, if you break it down into what people talk about or what they know you for, you say, "Well, I'm a guitar player, and I was in this band, but he's the guy who wrote Here I Go Again," yeah. You know, or "He's the guy who wrote Here I Go Again and with David Coverdale," because, you know, we're equal on it and whatever, and that's such I'm proud to be involved in. And you always want, as a writer, you want to be as successful as possible as a writer. And the thought of being number one in America is the dream of pretty much every musician you'll ever talk to from this side of the Atlantic. And there it is, you know, we're up there and we're number one. We being me and him as the writers. And there's a lot of people, a great deal many people in America who don't know I was ever in Whitesnake. But there's also a great many people who do. And as such, I've managed to be out of Whitesnake for twice as long as I was ever in it. And here we are talking about it because it's still relative in my career, because I have to, I don't have to play. I enjoy playing. If I played, you know, whether it's a 3,000 festival or a 10,000 festival, or I go into one of the book clubs, you know, with 150 people, you know, if you don't play it, they're going to be disappointed.
Yeah.
And you've got to play it the way it was made as well.
I'm not asking you to tell me how much money you made out of it, but does it still pay now, many years later, even in the era of streaming and so forth?
Not so much from the streaming. That's got to be sorted from a writer's point of view. But Here I Go has been one of the great synchronization songs for movies and campaigns. And, I have to, you know, it's been very good to me and given me everything I've been able to do post being in the band, because most of my contemporaries, you know, a lot of guys, much superior musicians or guitar players to me or whatever, but who didn't write anything during their tenure, you know, as 25 to 35 year olds in a band, who, you know, with this pandemic, for instance, the last year and a half, 2 years, you know, I really do feel for them because they're still gigging out there 5 days a week and relying on their gigs. Those gigs are disappearing. I don't have to really go out and do anything. I still enjoy doing the gigs when I play them, but, you know, the royalties and the success of Whitesnake post my being part of it also obviously added, because the sales of that record anyway went through the roof to start with in America when it was number one. And it was number one, I think, in three different versions all over the world. And it's, you know, people, Steve Lukather is funny. he calls it mailbox money. You know, the as we're speaking today, it's been on the radio in America probably got 500 times.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Mailbox money. That's a good one.
Yeah, that's a good one. That is.
I've never heard that one. Oh, that must be. That
Where must are you nice. Mailbox money? You know. So.
But you must also think just how lucky that you played it to David Coverdale, and presumably he was in a certain mood to be receptive, and then you played it to John Lord, and John Lord go, that's a hook.
Yeah.
And it's all the little human reactions, isn't it, that turns into something.
We have a similar thing. On every album, something, there's a spark. We did it on Love Hunter with a song called Walking in the Shadow of the Blues. That one stood the test of time really well. Fool for Your Loving was the first Whitesnake hit. Fool for Your Loving was the BBC's... you know, we play rock music. No, you don't. We play Whitesnake. And we got away with that for a while. And that was a big hit. Fool for Your Loving was, you know, that was the breakthrough one, really. Ready and Willing was the breakthrough album. But people remember Donington Park and the big, or Reading with 35,000 people. But also there were people, 200 people at Lincoln Tech when we began, when we were called Dinosaurs and I was 26 years old. Right. You know, the whole punk thing was going on. And, you know, what? How dare these old guys start new bands? You know, I think I was 26.
Yes.
Was that remotely a threat, that? You always thought, if you read the music press at the time, you know, there was the rise of ska, there was disco, there was punk rock, you know, there can't be a market for these old people playing kind of classic rock. No. That, I can't imagine you were even remotely bothered by that.
Never gave it a moment's thought.
No.
No, a punk to me was... we were recording the Pace Ashton Lord album in Munich at the famous Musicland Studios. And just being there was a trip for me. You know, it's like this guy from the Villages, you know. And they talk about, we've got this punk music. And now and again, after being there for 2 or 3 weeks or whatever, somebody come over or somebody would fly you over the Movie Maker or whatever. And we'd be reading your articles or not, you know. And we read about this punk this and punk that. We said, well, punk is the guys in Clint Eastwood movies. Well, you know, make my day, punk. Because we were sort of out there, away from it, in a bubble, really. Right. And because it was quite quick, that went through, like, the summer of 76, was it? 77. Yeah, 77. And it was suddenly the punk. I remember saying to John, I think, it was, what's all this punk business? And he said, I have no idea, dear boy. You know. So I don't really care.
I love your impersonations of John and also David. David's got a slightly posh accent, actually, hasn't he?
He seems to have a very, very, I think there's still a lot of the northern boy in him, though.
You're making them both sound a bit like Keith Richards.
No, there was Viv Stanchel, all that stuff, wasn't there? Yeah. There wasn't an era where rock heroes talked like that. They were like theatricals, weren't they? Donald Wolfitz or something like that. Bernie, that and millions of other tales are in Bernie Marsden's book, Where's My Guitar?, which we heartily recommend.
It's really, really
to anybody who's enjoyed what we've been talking about. And you know, when this bloody war is over, Bernie, you'll be out talking about it at bookshops and so forth, and playing music once again.
And then we'll talk about the next one. Now that I'm a signed HarperCollins writer, as you know.
Volume 2.
Yes, there you go.
Good. I got to do something.
Look, it's been lovely talking to you. Great. Thanks very much for your time.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.